From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, Unraveling the Mystery of Lyme Disease, we talk with Dr. Jonathan Edlow. His new book, Bullseye, describes how doctors piece together clues from a baffling array of symptoms afflicting people in Connecticut to pinpoint a new disease. Also, we meet Chef Jeremiah Tower. In the 1970s, he was chef and co-owner of Chez Panisse in Berkeley, California, where he helped create what came to be known as California cuisine. He has a new memoir. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the reissue of the dynamic sound patterns of the Rod Levitt Orchestra. And book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews Maisie Dobbs, the debut novel by Jacqueline Winspear. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Libya has set up a compensation fund for the families of victims of the 1988 bombing of Pan Am Flight 103 and is expected to send a letter to the UN Security Council soon to accept responsibility. NPR's Michelle Kellerman reports.
According to a lawyer close to the case, Libya set up an escrow account at the Bank for International Settlements. It's to pay $2.7 billion, or $10 million, for each of the 270 victims of the bombing. United Nations diplomats say that the U.S., Britain, and Libya have also signed off an agreement to have Libya accept responsibility for the bombing that could pave the way for a U.N. Security Council debate on lifting sanctions against Libya, sanctions that were suspended after Muammar Gaddafi's regime handed over two suspects, one of whom was indicted. Diplomats caution that there still could be last-minute glitches, but in a sign that the long-standing diplomatic dispute is nearly over, families of the victims were invited to go to the State Department on Friday. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, Washington.
Some military families have formed a group that's demanding an end to the U.S. occupation of Iraq. The group, called Military Families Speak Out, launched a campaign today in Washington called Bring Them Home Now. Co-founder Nancy Lesson stressed that the campaign is not an attack on the troops serving in Iraq.
Supporting our troops does not mean supporting the invasion and occupation of Iraq or the job descriptions President Bush recklessly crafted for our loved ones. In fact, it means just the opposite.
Lesson says her group has about 600 members. Temperatures are easing in Britain, France, and Spain after Europeans roasted for more than a week in a record heat wave. Jerome Sokolowski reports from Madrid.
Cooler air has brought relief to France, Britain, and the northern coast of Spain, where temperatures have dropped into the 70s. But Germans and Swiss are still sweating through 90-degree weather, and southern Spain and Portugal continue to bake with temperatures close to 110 in some parts. The heat wave has overwhelmed emergency services. In France, military hospitals are taking patients from overburdened civilian hospitals. And in Spain, the military has sent in materiel and is considering troop deployments to help fight forest fires across the country. There are huge traffic jams along the coast between Barcelona and France, where authorities have closed off a major highway because of approaching wildfires. For NPR News, I'm Jerome Sokolowski in Madrid.
Stock prices closed lower today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 38 points to close at 9,271 in moderate trading. The NASDAQ Composite Index lost a fraction today to close at 1,686. The S&P 500 lost 6 to close at 984. This is NPR News. Oil officials in Turkey say Iraq has begun pumping crude oil into a pipeline to a Turkish port in the Mediterranean Sea. It's the first time since the Iraq War that the country's been able to deliver fresh supplies of oil to the Turkish port. The Bush administration has said it eventually expects Iraqi oil sales to pay much of the cost of reconstruction. More and more high schools across the country are requiring students to pass exit exams. And according to a study that came out today, those exams are getting tougher. NPR's Claudio Sanchez reports.
The study by the Center for Education Policy in Washington, D.C. concludes that new state tests have had a positive impact on school curricula and instruction. But many cash-strapped states and school districts don't have the money to develop good tests. Poorly designed tests, the report argues, are more likely to hurt the quality of education that students receive, especially if they're low-income, learning-disabled, and non-English-speaking kids. The gaps in test scores between blacks and whites and between Latinos and whites are especially worrisome. The report, though, is most critical of the punitive use of test scores in at least 19 states where schools withhold students' diplomas if they do poorly on so-called exit exams. Last year, tens of thousands of students in Florida, New York, and Massachusetts did not receive their high school diplomas because of low test scores. Claudio Sanchez, NPR News, Washington.
Montana Governor Judy Martz says she won't run for re-election. Martz's decision came after a difficult first term in which her approval ratings had fallen to about 20%. Lieutenant Governor Carl Oz has said he may enter the Republican primary for governor, which already has three other candidates. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Procter & Gamble, makers of Metamucil, natural fiber for maintaining regularity, in powder, wafers, and capsules. Metamucil.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Terry Gross. The tick-borne illness, which infects more than 18,000 people a year in this country, is known as Lyme disease, but its story began nearly a century ago across the ocean from Lyme, Connecticut. In his new book, Bullseye, Unraveling the Medical Mystery of Lyme Disease, Dr. Jonathan Edlow reveals that as early as the 1880s, medical researchers in Europe had identified rashes and confusing neurological syndromes caused by tick bites. But it wasn't until the early 70s when separate clusters of baffling cases of skin rashes and arthritis started showing up in Connecticut that doctors assembled the big picture. When deer ticks bite humans, they transmit a corkscrew-shaped bacterium known as a spirochete, which causes symptoms that vary widely from person to person. Dr. Jonathan Edlow has practiced emergency medicine in Boston for more than 20 years. He teaches at the Harvard Medical School, and he's been tracking Lyme disease since reports first surfaced. I asked him to tell us about the first cluster of Lyme disease cases in this country.
There were two Navy doctors at the submarine base in Groton, Connecticut back in the mid-70s. And during the summer of 1975, into the internist's office, Bill Mast, a patient came with a rash and a fever and sore joints, and he didn't know what it was, so he sent him to the dermatologist, Bill Burrows, who was stationed on the base. He didn't know what it was, but it seemed like something that probably should be treated with an antibiotic. And back then, they selected penicillin. Over the course of that summer of 75, they collected four patients with the exact same syndrome, a big rash, fevers, and they went through the literature. They knew about Rudolf Scrimenti's case report from 1970. They knew about some of the European data. And Bill Burrows was the dermatologist, had a habit of going to the Yale Department of Dermatology Grand Rounds each Wednesday morning. And he presented these cases because he still didn't know what it was. And one of the European doctors in the audience suggested that this was a disease that had been seen in Europe, erythema migrans.
Now, pretty much at the same time, families in Lyme, Connecticut were falling ill with similar symptoms, right? And you described the case of Polly Murray. She was devastated by undiagnosed symptoms for years in Lyme. What did doctors make of her case? And did they have any communication with these other doctors in nearby Groton, Connecticut?
Well, initially they didn't have any communication. Initially, Mrs. Murray and other members of her family, even the dog of the family, had been having all kinds of symptoms, joint symptoms, neurologic symptoms, skin symptoms for many, many years. They saw dozens of doctors. But they never, and they were given many diagnoses, but there really was no diagnosis that sort of fit. And at one point, they even suggested that Mrs. Murray was a little bit psychologically unstable. She finally persisted and in October of 1975 called the State Department of Public Health in Connecticut.
And at this point, did all of the doctors hook up and did all of the information end up in one place, or what happened?
No, this was, you know, before medical records were computerized. But what did happen is that one town over in Old Lyme, Connecticut, there was another woman, Judy Mensch, whose daughter, Anne, had a joint arthritis. And she was taken to the hospital. She was diagnosed with having juvenile rheumatoid arthritis, which is a fairly uncommon disease. And Mrs. Mensch had grown up in Manhattan, had known lots and lots of people, had never heard of juvenile rheumatoid arthritis. And within her one country block in Old Lyme, Connecticut, there were five children with that diagnosis. And this seemed just incredulous to her. So she started talking to doctors, and then she finally called about 1 week after Mrs. Mensch. She called the Department of Public Health in Connecticut as well.
Sociologists talk about a theory of a tipping point for social phenomena in which it launches, something launches into the public consciousness, or in the case of an epidemic, into the consciousness of the medical community. So was there a point with this story of Lyme at which all of these factors came together and tipped the balance for Lyme?
Well, I certainly think that 1975 would be that year. You have the Navy docs at the Groton sub-base reporting their four cases. You've got Mrs. Mensch and Mrs. Murray calling the State Department of Public Health. And initially, they were blown off. They were told by the person answering the phone that arthritis is not a reportable disease, and therefore there's nothing we can do. Fortunately, that person took some written messages and left them for the person who was the acting communicable diseases chief, a man named David Snydman. And when Snydman came back from vacation, he was in Europe at the time, he had these two messages about these two women reporting clusters of arthritis. He had been trained at the CDC in epidemiology, and to him, rather than just blowing these women off, he was intrigued. He wasn't bothered by the fact that, you know, there was a round peg in a square hole. And he got curious, he called the women up, and he realized that something was going on.
How did the medical community then arrive at the conclusion that it was tick-borne?
Well, the tick part had to do with a couple pieces of evidence. One of them was that as they began looking at the evidence, they realized that this skin rash, erythema migrans, had first been described in 1909 by a Swedish dermatologist. And he had described with that original case that it was associated by a tick bite. So that was one line of evidence from Europe. The second was that both Mrs. Mensch and Mrs. Murray in their initial interviews had a mother's intuition or a hunch that there had been a lot more ticks in the area over the last few years and just sort of wondered aloud whether it could be ticks. And then the third line of evidence was a specific epidemiologic study that the departments of medicine and epidemiology at Yale undertook, which is they looked at the communities on the west bank of the Connecticut River, which were Lyme and Old Lyme and East Haddam, and they compared the rate of erythema migrans and the amount of ticks on mice and deer to that of the cities on the west bank of the Connecticut River, and found that it was like 13 times higher. So the same side of the river, the east bank, had more erythema migrans and also a lot more ticks, like 13 times more. So there are all three of those lines of evidence. And I guess the fourth one is that when you looked at the patients who were sick, it was almost never patients who lived in the city centers. It was all patients that lived more out in the woods and in the suburban areas.
Now, how does the tick transmit the disease? And I understand this involves tick spit.
It involves tick spit, tick saliva. They're disgusting little creatures. And basically, when these ticks bite people, they feed for several days, sometimes as long as a week. And the bacteria, the spirochetes, migrate from the intestine of the tick into the saliva and get injected into the skin, essentially.
I'm thinking there are plenty of deer in this country. Why did this syndrome or this disease surface in Lyme, Connecticut?
Well, it's a good question. I'm not sure that I have the answer to that. Certainly in places where there are a lot of deer and there are a lot of mice and there are this particular kind of tick, it sort of brought all the elements in the environment necessary for Lyme disease to develop. There were certainly, and the other thing I should mention is that the deer herds are actually bigger now than they were, say, 30 or 40 years ago. And the reason that the deer are important is that the adult phase of the tick spends the winter on the deer. That's their preferred animal. And they mate on the deer. So the more deer, the more ticks. And in fact, the deer herds have been increasing in the northeastern United States for many decades.
Now, there is a prevailing view of Lyme that it's a disease born of the growth of the suburbs, that there are more and more highly populated suburban areas in close proximity to rural areas, and that means more and more deer in close proximity to human beings, which mean more deer ticks on our skin. And
that's exactly correct.
And that scenario is held true.
That's true. And the same thing happened in Europe. You know, after World War II, a lot of the forests had been bombed. A lot of the deer had been hunted for food. A lot of the wooded areas had been chopped down for the rebuilding of Europe after the war. And in Western Europe, these old world forests began to regrow, and with it the deer herds. And therefore, the same sort of thing happened in Western Europe.
Now, how does Lyme generally present? What are the symptoms? And does it present differently in different people, children, adults? And I realize we're wandering into something very controversial already.
Yeah, well, the symptoms for the most part, and this is, if you were to open a textbook of medicine right now and read about the symptoms of Lyme, it would tell you that after a tick bite, if you get Lyme disease, and only about 3 or 4% of people bitten by a tick will actually get Lyme, the most common symptom is this unusual rash that's called erythema migrans. We'll just call it EM for short. And this rash often looks like a bullseye or a target lesion, but not always. It can just be a big, flat, red rash. And approximately 80% of people who contract Lyme disease will have this skin lesion.
What if you don't get the rash? How would you know you have Lyme disease?
Well, that's a good question, and some people will have just a plain old flu-like illness, and by that I just mean a fever and chills and muscle aches and joint pains without any rash. And as you might imagine, there's probably 100 diseases that would fit that description, and one might not be thinking about Lyme disease. It's also important to recognize that only about 20 to 25% of patients with Lyme disease will remember having been bitten by a tick. So if you haven't had the tick bite, which would put you in the majority, and you have just a fever and chills, you know, Lyme disease is not the first thing that comes to mind. In addition, some people are bitten, infected, but don't develop any symptoms, and some of these patients might develop symptoms later on down the line.
Whenever there's a controversial disease that people have theories about or people are unsatisfied with the recommended conventional therapies, they come up with alternative therapies. And you trace a kind of fascinating sidebar to this story, which is that in at least one case, someone tried something called malaria therapy, which was
right.
Once applied to syphilis.
Correct. It's an interesting story. This man got a call from his daughter that she was going down to Mexico to purposefully contract malaria in order to treat her Lyme disease. And, you know, he thought she was nuts until he began looking into it. In fact, she was responding to a letter to the editor in no less than the New England Journal of Medicine from a physician who's well known to everybody, Harry Heimlich, the thoracic surgeon who invented the Heimlich maneuver. And Dr. Heimlich had been watching a television program one night about Lyme disease, and he said, this sounds a lot like syphilis, and began advocating malaria therapy. Well, the history of that goes back to at the turn of the century, the turn of the last century, that is, syphilis was a huge public health burden in Western Europe and here, and a large percentage of patients in mental institutions had late stages of syphilis because many of the symptoms were primarily psychiatric. And people would die within 4 to 5 years of this. There was no treatment at the time. They were treated by psychiatrists, and an Austrian psychiatrist named Jarig Wagner actually noticed that some of his patients who were early in the course of late syphilis, when they had a severe fever from some other illness, actually seemed to get quite a bit better. So he began giving patients malaria. He would take blood from an infected patient, give the patient with late syphilis malaria. They would develop very high fevers, and he found that a large percentage of them got much better, and some of them actually had complete recoveries and went back to their jobs and work. This was unheard of. This is like having something, you know, for HIV infection these days that totally cured them. So he won the Nobel Prize. I can't remember if it was 1926 or 1927, but something that seems fairly outlandish to us right now was something that won this man the Nobel Prize in Medicine less than a century ago.
So this woman, did she contract malaria, and how did it go?
Well, she did. The description of this was by her father, who said that one night she was sitting by the a riverbank in Belize for several hours at dusk and got a few hundred mosquito bites but didn't contract malaria. She actually went back to Mexico a few times and finally was injected with the blood of a child that had malaria. They used a child because they wanted to minimize the risk of other blood-borne infections. She did get malaria. She did have high spiking fevers, but unfortunately her symptoms did not get better, the symptoms that had been attributed to the chronic Lyme disease. But I think it shows you the degree of desperation that one may go to when one is having chronic symptoms.
I'm talking with Jonathan Edlow. He's the author of Bullseye, Unraveling the Medical Mystery of Lyme Disease. He's an assistant professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School. Let's take a break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. Jonathan Edlow. His new book is A Medical History of Lyme Disease. It's called Bullseye. Lyme disease is generally described as having three stages. What are the three stages, and what are the symptoms of each stage?
Yeah, they're sort of defined as follows. The early localized stage means when the disease, the spirochete, is localized into the skin. It hasn't spread anywhere. And that's where you get the rash, erythema migrans, or fevers and chills, maybe a swollen lymph gland. The second stage is called early disseminated Lyme disease, and that's when, in the early stages, the early weeks to months after the spirochete getting into the bloodstream, it causes symptoms. And those symptoms can be in the neurologic system, for example, a meningitis that's usually fairly mild, a Bell's palsy, where the facial nerve becomes paralyzed and half of the face is paralyzed. Sometimes it's cardiac symptoms, where you get an extremely slow pulse rate. Occasionally you can get arthritis. And sometimes it's just multiple skin rashes. The spirochete goes throughout the bloodstream and you get 20 erythema migrans lesions instead of one. The later stage is called late disseminated. And most of those symptoms are either joint problems with arthritis or neurologic problems, and they fall into two categories. One is cognitive problems, where your concentration is off and your sleeping is off and you have a tremendous amount of fatigue, memory is poor. And then the other is what's called peripheral neuropathy, where you get either numbness or pains in the hands and the feet. Due to Lyme disease within the brain and spinal cord and peripheral nerves.
What's the currently recommended treatment of Lyme? And this has been really controversial and gotten politicized in the last decade. And there are basically two camps. There are people who advocate long-term antibiotic therapy to avoid these long-term symptoms, and others who say there might be no such thing as long-term symptoms and that taking antibiotics for long periods of time is not necessary. So what's the thinking on this now? Is there any consensus?
Yeah. Well, we should break it down into several categories. First of all, I think most people would agree that early diagnosed Lyme disease, meaning the first couple few months, is fairly easy to treat with antibiotics. And that antibiotics for most early presenting patients, 2 to 3 weeks is adequate. And for those that are diagnosed in the first weeks to months, sort of a middle stage, a second stage, that 3 to 4 weeks is almost always enough. Most people would agree with that, not everybody. The second piece is that it's not true that people don't have chronic symptoms. I think everybody would agree, both what I call the alternative camp and the conventional camp, would all agree that patients who have had Lyme disease, that some of them, people who are late to be treated, will have chronic symptoms. The question is, what are those symptoms being caused by? And that's where a lot of the controversy comes in. People who believe in long-term antibiotic therapy, and by that I mean months and sometimes years, believe that there are still live spirochetes in the patient, and it's the live spirochete that's causing these symptoms. There are other potential causes for the symptoms, and the conventional camp believes that it's one of those other causes. And there are different ones. It could be that there's already permanent tissue damage from the original infection, and the symptom is just due to cells that have died and are causing symptoms. It's possible that there are symptoms due to an untreated co-infection. It's possible that after the original infection, the immune system has been revved up and that it's the immune system that's causing the ongoing symptoms. It's possible that the Lyme disease has triggered some other second separate disease like fibromyalgia or chronic fatigue syndrome. And obviously, you're going to treat each of those differently. And it's also possible that some patients have multiple mechanisms of disease, or that some of the mechanisms are true in one patient, but other mechanisms are true in another patient. So again, it gets fairly complicated.
Let's talk about removing a tick. How do you do it? What's the best way? What's the recommended way?
Well, the recommended way is to take a tweezers or a forceps that are very, very thin, and try to get as close to the skin as possible where the tick is, and kind of pinch a little bit, and then lift upwards sort of firmly. And over about, 30 to 45 seconds, most ticks will lift off. What one should not do is put alcohol or turpentine or a burnt match or Vaseline, because sometimes that will make the tick kind of squeeze the infectious contents into the person rather than not.
Well, Jonathan Edlow, I enjoyed talking with you today. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Jonathan Edlow's new book is Bullseye, Unraveling the Medical Mystery of Lyme Disease. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Warner Brothers Pictures and Matchstick Men, a Ridley Scott film, with Nicolas Cage and Sam Rockwell as a couple of pros in the small-time con, in theaters Friday, September 12th. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, fried Sonoma goat cheese with arugula and pesto. We talk with Chef Jeremiah Tower about the origins of California cuisine. His new memoir about his three decades as a chef and restaurateur is called California Dish. Kevin Whitehead reviews the dynamic sound patterns of the Rod Levitt Orchestra. And Maureen Corrigan reviews the debut novel, Maisie Dobbs. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave. In 1960, trombonist Rod Levitt was a veteran of Dizzy Gillespie's and Gil Evans' big bands and was working in the orchestra at Radio City Music Hall when he formed an octet to play his original music. That band eventually made four albums for Riverside and RCA. In recent years, a few critics have clamored for their re-release. The first of these albums has now been reissued. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has an appreciation.
His master's voice by Rod Levitt, the master in question being Duke Ellington. Levitt catches the flavor of his bright woodwinds and wah-wah brass, the shifting textures, concise solos, and rhythmic drive. The tribute is doubly impressive, as Levitt's octet was half the size of Duke's 15-piece band. These days, an Ellington impression that good could win you a Pulitzer, but back then even Duke couldn't get one. And anyway, Levitt had other good ideas. Playing in other folks' bands, Rod Levitt never cared much for the plunger mute, but when he put his own group together, he kept hearing that wah-wah sound in his head. He named that piece we just heard Holler, thinking of Slave's Field Hollers. That such an inspiration could seize a dentist's son from Portland, Oregon, says a lot about the dynamic nature of American culture. We all crib from each other. Rod Levitt's musicians came from Broadway shows, Stokowski's Symphony of the Air, and big bands from Jerry Mulligan's to Ellington's. Trumpeter Rolf Erickson was in fact working with Duke when he recorded this music. It comes from the CD, The Dynamic Sound Patterns of the Rod Levitt Orchestra on OJC. One reason the octet could pass for an orchestra is that Levitt rehearsed them like mad, revising and discarding pieces and trying to coax or trick them into playing less politely. He liked blaring harmonies and primary colors and like to keep things moving. That's George Marge on English horn. Counter all the quick change material, Rod Levitt was also fond of taking a simple motif and stretching and developing it over the course of a piece, like his Upper Bay, meant to depict competing activities in an Air Force barracks, including a noisy card game and a band rehearsal. Buzz Wren on alto saxophone. Rod Levitt made three more albums after this one in the mid-1960s. The critics liked them, but they didn't catch on with the public. Levitt got discouraged, disbanded, and went into advertising, where he wrote catchy jingles for One-A-Day Vitamins, the New York Daily News, and others. So millions of people finally did get to hear some of his music. But I still like the non-commercial stuff best.
Kevin Whitehead writes for the Chicago Reader and the Chicago Sun-Times. He reviewed the reissue, The Dynamic Sound Patterns of the Rod Levitt Orchestra. Coming up, the American Culinary Revolution. This is Fresh Air. Years ago, you couldn't walk into your local supermarket and find baby spinach or extra virgin olive oil or jars of sun-dried tomatoes and mango salsa. It took a culinary revolution known as California cuisine to bring this about, which also brought with it endless individual pizzas with goat cheese and pesto, and arguably the rise of the celebrity chef. Jeremiah Tower was there at the creation, and he makes a case for that with his new memoir, California Dish. In it, Tower reminisces about his first job as a professional chef in the early 1970s at Alice Waters' restaurant Chez Panisse in Berkeley, California. Tower eventually became a co-owner of Chez Panisse. In the 80s and 90s, he ran several other successful restaurants in the Bay Area, including Santa Fe Grill and Stars. He's the author of two cookbooks, Jeremiah Tower Cooks and Jeremiah Tower's New American Classics, which won a James Beard Award. I talked with him recently about the evolution of his approach to cooking. You describe in your book that you'd worked at Chez Panisse for a while and you were searching for your identity as a chef or the mark that you were going to make with this bistro food. And you had an epiphany at one point on a rare vacation in Mexico that you had to do big, outlandish, non-traditional things based on traditional impulses. So what did that mean to you, and where did that lead you?
Well, I loved the old food, but I realized that, you know, we'd been doing regional. I mean, I had the idea to do regional festivals. So we started with the country food of the regions of France. And then when we ran out of regions and we were talking about Corsica and things like that, and I thought, that's really pushing it, you know, and I just realized that we were sitting in the middle of the most wonderful region of all called California, and we should just use those ingredients. There were the Monterey prawns that we'd drive down and get fresh. There was just the beginning of goat cheese. There were oysters from Tamales Bay, sometimes the live lobsters from the Mexican coast, and I just thought, we should develop our own kind of cuisine using California ingredients, but using the principles from the past, of all the great dishes of the past as well.
There's some great descriptions in the book about what lengths a chef has to go to get the freshest and the best ingredients. And you described the Oakland Italian, an Italian butcher, and that you'd get shoulder deep into drums filled with the blood and liver of calves to buy your stuff. What were you looking for in those drums?
Well, you know, that was an amazing place because they were just receiving these calves that were going down, hanging up from the truck, whizzing down into the warehouse. I used to stand there with a pail and grab the veal sweetbreads as they went by, because within half an hour, you know, they were going to be in boxes and put in the freezer. So the only way for me to get fresh things was to stand there and grab them out of the carcasses as they went by. And with the livers, they came in a big barrel and it was full of calf's blood. I mean, and I wanted the blonde ones, so I had to roll up my sleeves and dig in there to find them. Of course, the people who worked there thought I was absolutely crazy. Probably was.
You wanted the blonde livers because they're better? What? They taste better?
Yeah, the blonde livers of veal, they're milder, closer to foie gras, in a sense.
Now, it sounds as if two things were happening at once in the 70s in California. This idea that you should use the very freshest, locally grown, unique to California food, and also that you should, or that a restaurant offers more than food, it also offers entertainment.
And that we learned that entertainment was very important, more as well as the food. When we did for the champagne dinner, blue trout, and that's one of the three menus in the book in California Dish. And we brought these trout up from Garapata, where I'd had remembered they were since I was a child, and my grandfather took me down there. So we brought up these live trout in tanks and had bathtubs and pails and everything all over the kitchen with compressors putting air into the water. And every time there was an order, I'd grab a trout and kill it and shove it into the corbillon. But the first trout slipped out of my hands, went flopping across the floor just as a waiter was coming into the kitchen. So it went out into the dining room and ended up on some dowager's ankles. I mean, there were shrieks all over the all over the restaurant, and that really made the evening. Everyone came piling into the kitchen to see what we were doing. Then I knew that theater was at least half the story.
Now, you do write in the beginning of your book, though, that California cuisine would never have become discovered if it weren't for a few pushy French chefs. And this involves this involves a promotional event for Ocean Spray Cranberries in Newport, Rhode Island. So what's the story behind that claim?
Cranberries, yes, believe it or not, but it was an event that the agency for Ocean Spray was doing called Innovations. So they invited Guy Savoy, who was the young Turk in France at the time, to come to the United States and put on a dinner in front of 100 American food journalists to try and see, you know, what this so-called sauceless cuisine or sort of nouvelle cuisine as it was developing in France, what it was really like. Then they invited a couple of us California kids to come and do, you know, a funny little lunch to keep everybody's strength up. As we got to the mansion, we were in the kitchen and the French arrived and they said, you know, out, out, out. You know, we're the important ones here and we need the kitchen. So I looked around for a place to cook. And the only place, remembering a sense of theater, of course, that we put up a kitchen of grills and tables right in front of it where the journalists were going to have lunch. And we cooked in front of them. And that's the first time they had ever seen grilling and salsas and things like that. It was certainly the first time we ever saw cooking dessert on the charcoal grill as well. And it just caught their imagination. And that was when the term sort of California cuisine and what it meant, meaning charcoal grilling and salsas and everything, was plastered across every food section in America.
So you do a lot of grilling in California cuisine, or you did back then, but you did it then because of necessity?
Yes. Well, of course, we did a lot of grilling afterwards because that's what the press said California cuisine was. You know? but, you know, the only heat source we had out there were these 2 6-foot-long grills and mesquite charcoal. So we had to cook everything on there. And the dessert was actually a fruit ragout. And we just lined up all the sauté pans, put the fruit in, with the sugar syrup and a pinch of salt, and just in unison tossed them around until it was warm because we were serving it with coconut ice cream. So that the sight of, you know, six of us, each with a sauté pan in our hand and tossing them all in sequence, it was just wonderful to watch. Great theater.
Now, another icon of California cuisine became the little individual pizza with goat cheese and tomatoes pesto or whatever. And it sounds as if it's also kind of a funny, born of necessity story to how you first started serving those.
But so many of the things in the restaurant business that become legendary or great or most successful are born out of necessity. I mean, you can sit around for hours or weeks even trying to come up with a brilliant idea. But in my experience, it's, you know, it's the brilliant idea that because you're under pressure and you need something in 5 minutes. And that's exactly what happened with the individual pizzas. It was the third birthday of Chez Panisse, and I had written this menu, and I'd seen in a book on the south of France these things called panisse. And I thought, well, that's it. That's perfect, you know. But, of course, I didn't look to see what they were. I just quickly glanced over the recipe and saw they were little round things. And when I came to, when it came, got closer to the event, I made them, and they were absolutely disgusting because they were made out of chickpea flour.
But they were already on your menu, your printed menu.
I know, so I had to do something. So I just told everybody, oh, you know, panisse, they're just little pizzas kind of things. And everyone was happy. So we made them.
Now, eventually, California cuisine got a backlash was created. And I'm thinking of a few quotes that you point out in your book from classically trained French chefs, from food critics. One of my favorites is from a French chef in 1998 who writes that, or he said that California cuisine consists of things you don't normally hear of going together, like alligator fritters with a parsnip sauce. The alligator tastes like chicken and the parsnip tastes like turnips. It's frightening.
Sounds frightening to me.
So how aware were you of the backlash, and had you already moved on to a new kind of cooking by the time this came around?
Well, of course, what the backlash against was California cuisine redux. I mean, it was the people who didn't really understand it, who thought it was all about chic ingredients rather than perfectly controlled, simple, wonderful ingredients. So when people started putting kiwi fruit on top of squab, and then on balsamic vinegar on the plate, and raspberries and lemongrass that they thought had to be chopped up rather than made into an infusion, I mean, it just got impossible. You couldn't even eat the food after a while. So we never went there. I never went there. And also, you know, so that I distanced myself a little bit from all of that. We called it New American Cuisine, or the Eastern press called it New American Cuisine.
Now, I'm thinking that the ingredient revolution that was started by the California cuisine movement in the 70s and the 80s has really worked in this country. You can get boutique farm and baby vegetables and lettuces and organic wild rice and hothouse herbs and all of that pretty much everywhere. What's left for chefs to work with in terms of innovation? Or, you know, does that make it harder? Does that raise the bar?
It does raise the bar. I mean, at the end of California Dish, I say, you know, the revolution has worked, because you can go to Texas and see those amazing central markets, or you can be driving in Marathon, Florida, on the Keys, and see another amazing supermarket, and all the farmers' markets all over Union Square in New York and Philadelphia, everywhere. The revolution has worked, and it's all about ingredients. But the challenge now is not to find the ingredients so much, though that's still a huge part of any great chef's work. I think the innovation now with the chef in America is to step back and let the food, let the ingredients really speak, rather than saying this is the food of a famous chef. I mean, look at the biggest influence now on chefs in America is Spain. And those wonderfully crazy chefs in Spain sometimes put just one little ingredient on a plate. Of course, it's amazingly perfect and full of flavor and intriguing at the same time. So that's the challenge. It's not so much doing something new, but it's doing something new for yourself, which is to step back, let the food be famous.
Well, Jeremiah Tower, I want to thank you so much for talking. It was fun.
Thank you for inviting me on the show.
Jeremiah Tower's new memoir is California Dish. Coming up, a review of the new novel, Maisie Dobbs. This is Fresh Air. British writer Jacqueline Winspear grew up listening to her grandparents' stories of life in Britain and on the battlefield during World War I. She's woven their recollections into her first novel, called Maisie Dobbs. But book critic Maureen Corrigan says Maisie Dobbs mixes in a heavy dose of New Age therapies with its nostalgia.
Jacqueline Winspear's debut novel, Maisie Dobbs, is a quirky literary creation. If you cross-pollinate it, Vera Brittain's classic World War I memoir, Testament of Youth, with Dorothy Sayers' Harriet Vane mysteries, and a dash of the old PBS series Upstairs, Downstairs, you'd approximate the peculiar range of topics and tones within this novel. Neither flora nor fauna, fish nor fowl, it also behaves by turns like a romance, a tale of terror, an historical novel, and a primer on holistic health. Personally, I'm ready for a dose of the eclectic. So far, this season's big books have been the new Harry Potter, which is a wondrous but after all familiar phenomenon, and Hillary Clinton's autobiography, which I've dipped into at random and found to be as measured and monotonous as the annual report of some nonprofit agency. Maisie Dobbs takes too many risks to be flawless. In particular, the coincidences that structure its plot are too whopping. But overall, its intelligent eccentricity offers relief from the dopey doldrums of most other so-called summer books. Part of the fun of reading Maisie Dobbs is connecting the dots, figuring out how the daughter of a London costermonger, that is, vegetable seller, came to launch herself as a private investigator and psychologist. For that's how the 30-something Maisie advertises herself when the novel begins in the spring of 1929. As we readers learn through a teasing series of flashbacks, Maisie, at age 13, was placed in service to Lady Rowan Compton, a famous London suffragist. The young Maisie worked by day as a scruffy in-between maid. By night, however, she revealed herself to be a brilliant autodidact, sneaking into Lady Rowan's library to teach herself Latin and the collected works of Kierkegaard. Naturally, she's discovered one night by Lady Rowan, who, instead of sending the trespassing Maisie packing, eventually sponsored her studies at Girton College, Cambridge. Lady Rowan also introduced Maisie to a physician and mystic named Maurice Blanche, who tutored Maisie in science, philosophy, and what he calls the forensic science of the whole person. World War I, however, disrupted Maisie's singular education. She enlisted as a nurse, was sent to France, and fell in love with a young doctor whose fate remains obscure until the very end of the novel. Past and present intersect in Maisie's first big case. A client hires Maisie to check up on his wife, whom he suspects of infidelity. Through entertaining narrative twists and turns that take readers all over late 1920s London and the countryside, Maisie discovers an odd place called The Retreat. It's a kind of commune for servicemen whose disfiguring facial injuries have made them into figures of revulsion to the society they served. In order to ferret out the evil doings at The Retreat, Maisie has to confront her own, still gaping, psychological war wounds. In Maisie Dobbs, Winspear has concocted what's essentially a class-conscious, feminist fairy tale about a woman without advantages finding autonomy. Winspear shores up this engaging vision with plenty of solid historical detail. For instance, she vividly describes the pre-dawn fireplace cleaning rituals Maisie once performed as a maid, and later, off the battlefield, the routine she executes of disinfecting wounds with garlic juice. As befits a fairy tale, the cast of offbeat, benevolent secondary characters in the novel, like Lady Rowan and Maisie's noble vegetable hawker father, are very winning. But it's Maisie herself who's the most bizarre draw here. She's part clairvoyant, part intellectual, part New Age therapist. When she's questioning hesitant witnesses, she'll discreetly practice the art of touch, or invite them on a walk in the park to relax their muscles, and therefore their tongues. To the extent that it is a mystery, Maisie Dobbs tackles a big philosophical subject that has preoccupied so many other serious mystery novels. That is, how do human beings really come to know the truth? Unlike champions of pure reason like Sherlock Holmes, Maisie also relies on the wisdom of yoga, Freud, and Feng Shui to diagnose and heal a troubled world.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Maisie Dobbs by Jacqueline Winspear. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Megan Howell, and Anne-Marie Baldonado, with Patty Leswing, Jessica Chu, and Ian Chillog. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. For Terry Gross, I'm Barbara Bogave. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Bantam Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of The Moth Diaries, a novel about obsessions that drive people through adolescence by author Rachel Klein. This is NPR, National Public Radio. On the next Fresh Air, reporting on a decade of conflict in Africa, we talk with former war correspondent Aidan Hartley. In the 1990s, he covered Somalia, Rwanda, and the Congo. Hartley grew up in Africa, the son of a British colonial officer. His new memoir is called The Zanzibar Chest. I'm Barbara Bogave. Join us for the next Fresh Air.